Kia ora and welcome to the Athlete Development Show podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Craig Harrison, sports scientist, coach, and researcher focused on the developing athlete. Welcome to another episode of The Curious Mind. It's awesome to have you with us. Just before we do jump into today's show, just a reminder, if you've got any questions or comments or ideas that you'd love Dave and I to dig into on the show, please send them through. You can reach me at craig@athletedevelopmentproject.com. So today, Dave and I jump into ideas around creating culture. Dave, this season has spent his time leading the Westlake Boys First 11 group. So I questioned Dave on how he thinks about culture and how he went about setting that up to ensure his players were in the best environment for being their best selves. We talk about tournaments. Recent history at tournaments has led Dave to some curious observations about the beautiful thing that happens at tournaments, but also some areas of improvement. And we wrap this one up thinking a little bit about coach development. Both Dave and I are involved in environments helping coaches to be their best selves. And so we discuss a few essential ingredients for helping coaches create positive environments for their young people. So without further ado, please enjoy this curious conversation with Dave Wright. Welcome back to The Curious Mind. It's been a while between drinks, but super excited to get into this one. How are you?
Mate, I'm good, and I'm excited to be back. I know we've both been very busy. It's been a little bit longer, as you say, than normal. So certainly excited to see where the conversation goes today based on your recent travels and a few other things I've seen lately too.
Yeah, lots going on and some great experiences from your point of view with Westlake Boys and some really good results. So let's dive into it. Where are we going to start? We've got a bit of a list. how much content are we going to need to fill this one up? I think we've got plenty, so yeah. We might be back for a part two. But you've recently been to a tournament or three, and you've got some thoughts, some experiences. So why don't you share a little bit about what you've been up to, and we'll start to bring the tournament idea into focus.
Yeah, cool. Well, look, I think I juggle plenty of hats and was lucky to find myself doing some work with Westlake Boys High School this year, which is, I guess for those who aren't in New Zealand, is a fairly successful sporting school, let's say, and a good school. It's got good sort of reputation in New Zealand, and entered into the football program with a pretty ambitious group of players who, like most kids, just wanted to win it all. And that's easy to put down on a piece of paper, but not so easy to do. Great season with the boys and some real good learning for me. Nice to get my hands on a group of engaged and good players in a good competition, and just see what we could do in terms of creating culture, which is part of what I'm looking to do on my pro license course at the moment, is really looking at culture and values. Culture setting is kind of my action learning task, so I've been very conscious of doing that deliberately through the season.
I think we would probably agree that whenever we walk into an environment, first and foremost, it's what that environment stands for. And getting clarity around that, it's definitely been my journey of this is crucial in setting up the environment to then start tracking towards whatever it is, the outcomes that you're wanting to achieve. So give me a bit of a insight into that piece for Westlake. Like, did you spend a lot of time, was it already driven through the school and in terms of what the school stands for that you picked up and just implanted into the football world? Or did you really, you know, begin from the beginning?
Yeah, I think we've all got to acknowledge when you walk in anywhere, there's an existing culture, right? There's connection, perhaps disconnection. There's various levels of engagement. There's all sorts of environmental constraints that exist. So I've always probably, and I've written about this, but rambled on a little bit about the concern I have around elitism at times in school sport and the performance narrative seeping in there. So that was something that I was conscious of. And as the season went on, I saw quite a lot of anxiety, not just with players from our group, but players across different schools, where the push for winning was becoming detrimental to the performance of players. So that was something that was addressed on the fly. But certainly in terms of trying to establish a culture with a new group as a new coach, you really only get one shot at that. So we did spend some time working on some sessions around what they wanted their team to be about, what their objectives were, what they valued. And then we boiled it down to sort of five key values from their perspective. I sort of mapped out some expectations from my perspective, and then we had a few agreed non-negotiables around the group. So that took some time, and we had a few check-ins during the season when perhaps we had some challenging moments. So it's cool to kind of reflect on when we, you know, had a dip in performance, let's say. We had various things we had to deal with outside of the on-the-pitch stuff, which, like any, you know, when you're working with a group of teenage lads, these things come up. So, yeah, there was a lot of purpose around establishing and trying to continually check back to those values and check back to what we're about. And brotherhood was one of their, was their primary, like their main value, that connection piece. And a lot of the players have spoken about the positive connection in the group this year. And speaking to colleagues recently over the last couple of weeks since the season's finished, it's been really cool to sort of look back and think about the power of doing things from an empathetic perspective, but also doing things with love and genuine care, which if I reflect on my own coaching for 20-odd years ago when I started, it certainly wasn't from a place of, it was from a place of caring and wanting to help people, but it wasn't from a place of anything but thinking about the result when I first started. And I think that that mindset has shifted. So
is that something that comes with experience and not sort of mindless wandering experience? Like yeah. There needs to be some intent there, but in having kids, I mean, both you and I have got young children kicking around the place. I mean, that changes the game for sure.
Yeah, kids definitely change it. But I also think the more I've learned and the more people I've spoken to and been around in coaching and athlete development is just connection, the importance of relationships and people. And again, having a conversation with a mutual friend this week around how so many organizations still get their culture wrong around people, whether that's sport or otherwise, it's still an issue for people. So yeah, I think ensuring that the players have belonging, they have ownership, they have connection, there's honesty in the environment, and that's the one thing they genuinely wanted from me, and I was able to give that to them regularly in different ways.
I know we want to get into tournaments, but you're bringing so many questions to mind. Now, we did a piece of research with a master's student, 2019, Sam McKenzie. It's actually been one of the most enjoyable pieces of research we did, and really influential in practice. And it was with First 15 Rugby, and he spoke to the players around their perception of the experience. And it was a qualitative piece of research, so he spoke to the boys, looked at those conversations, and then tried to find themes across a number of schools. And one of the themes was brotherhood. So it makes sense that that's what, you know, a lot of teenage boys are after, and developmentally speaking, it makes sense, right? But there was a risk to that brotherhood in the way that the adults in the environment, the coaches, the parents, turned up, be it. And most of the time that was present when the competition was happening. So the brotherhood was there, and they were given lots of autonomy around creating the brotherhood until it came to match day. So can you speak to that idea? Was that, like, how did you navigate?
Yeah, it's such a good question, because first of all, I think that brotherhood needs to be theirs, but you've also got a group of staff who are connected to the group and care about the group, and you want to bring everyone along. So that connection, there needs to be, I think, at times some distance between players and staff to ensure that there's a level of you know, respect. And it's not about control, it's just about perhaps that little bit of distance at times, where if you get too close, it becomes harder to make decisions that need to be made. But yeah, I think if we go back to the point around values, like, values are tested when pressure's on. And so whether that's values as to who you are as a person or what you are as a group, or whether that's a style of play where suddenly you're chasing the game and you want to keep the ball but you play long ball instead because it's more direct and it's safe and it's easy, like, they get tested when pressure's on. So game day is pressure at whatever level, because if you're an adult leading a group of kids, you want them to do well, and, you know, you want them to represent you. So a couple of things I was conscious of at the start of the season was trying to be as disciplined in my own behavior on the sideline as possible. It's not easy to be perfect there, right? We all feel the red line, and I know there were times where I probably could have been better, but overall I feel like teams mirror their coaches. So if you can behave in a way that is calm and respectful towards others, then generally that will be mirrored by the group. So engaging with officials and moaning too much about decisions was something I was just like, I'm not going to do that, because they're learning, they're here on a, you know, to facilitate the game.
As a coach and as a male coach within a male environment, how do you think about alphas? Do you play a role? And I'm thinking about developmental psychology and, yep, and the importance, the benefits and the cons of alphas and what that means. Like, do you think about your own role as being an alpha or another position in the tribe, so to speak?
I think you've got to be a leader, and I think you can do that in different ways. There's plenty of those characters around. I don't see it as being that effective in this day and age with young people particularly. And I think if I reflect on the most successful interventions, and when I say that, that might be a halftime talk or it might be a moment at training. Halftime talk, for example, the most successful or impactful halftime talks I think I had this year, and it's anecdotal because I'm still waiting on survey feedback from the players because I am surveying the group around some of this stuff, but is when I sat amongst them at their level, and my strategy there would generally be, I would be very clear on the three or four things we were going to cover. I'd give myself a couple of minutes before going in. And then when I went in, I'd allow the players 2, 3, 4 minutes more if they needed it to talk to each other, talk to me, bounce ideas. What are they seeing? What are they feeling? And for me, that's not alpha behavior. That's me trying to step back and be a facilitator and be amongst them and sort of almost smell and feel the room. And I can only recall one instance this year where one of the players apparently went and said to his dad, it's the only time I've seen Dave really get a bit mad at us. And it was when we were drastically underperforming in a moment where I wanted to put some demands on them. So I think, you know, masculinity presents such an interesting challenge around what coaching is and how we behave. There's no doubt when you chuck a tracksuit on, you lead a team, we all have egos. You go out and behave in certain ways, whether that's replicating what you see on TV if you're an inexperienced coach, or just trying to be a male leader in a male environment. You do want to set standards, drive standards, support performance, these things. But for me, it can be done in so many different ways. And I've genuinely, as I've got to know the group and bonded with the group and bonded with the staff, more and more I've been thinking, what can I genuinely do to show that I care, which will enhance performance? And I can share an example of that before our last league game, where I went and decided, what can I do that keeps the process the same before the game, where they had to win this game to win the league? So they...
And by the way, like, I think it is important to bring our listeners' attention to your results. We don't do this a lot, but connecting how we get there, yeah, to the outcomes, like, that's my life's work. So I mean, you had a fantastic season results wise I mean, you won it all. And so I just wanted to make sure that people listening and were aware that what you're talking to actually resulted in some good outcomes as well.
Yeah, and like, we all love the shiny objects, right? The kids love the shiny objects. They've been moonwalking around for a couple of weeks since the season finished. But to put down on paper that they wanted to win four things and to win four things, which is very difficult to do, was superb. But my real pride is in the process and the way we manage so many different things. So going back to the point around, like, doing those things that, from a perspective of care, like, my decision was, well, I want to keep the process the same before the game. I don't want to, you know, throw the routine of the players or make this a sort of a special occasion. It is an occasion. They're aware it's an occasion. They don't need me to tell them that. But what I did is I went to a few players from respective clubs abroad, a couple of coaching colleagues, and said, hey, can you just send me like a 30-second video through Instagram and wishing the boys well, tell them to trust the process, tell them to trust each other, and just enjoy the fact that they're effectively in a final to do something that the school hadn't done in 23 years. I managed to put about 3 or 4 minutes together, combine that with 20 of their best goals from the season in a four-minute video, and just bought the telly and an extension lead to the changing rooms. And
so let's
it was like, impactful.
Yeah, and I love it because that roots are in positive psychology. I had this conversation with a parent the other day, and they were talking to me about what they can do prior to their boy going out to compete.
Yeah.
And I think one simple idea, which wasn't a great, you know, conveyed in that example, was we need to show what they're good at.
Mm.
Like, let's spend time on their strengths so we can show them what they're great at. They've done the hard work. They've earned their place, and dwell less on you know, the threats.
Yep.
Totally. Which is super cool.
Yeah.
Like, real simple. And I know lots of people do it sometimes more unconsciously, but yeah, really doubling down on the stuff that your team or your son or your daughter does really well, whether it's in the car ride or the changing room or whatever.
Yeah, and I think it's easy sometimes because, you know, I think I've probably referred to Stephen Rolnick's work in the past, but this idea of coaches being deficit detectives, it's super controllable and super easy to pick up what we can fix or attempt to fix or believe we can fix, and we can't always fix it, you know, like, so looking at the positive things and looking at what players do, pumping up their tires in front of their mates, like for a teenage boy, and that's not to do that every week, like I'm not talking about dishing out praise without consideration, but if a player is underperforming and you know they can be in a better place, it might be calling them out to say, hey, I know you're superb at this and I know you can do better for your team, you've shown that, and that might be one-to-one or it might be in front of the group depending on how well you know that player, but without a doubt, like, reinforcing those things is critical. And I think when it comes to those moments, yeah, like, it doesn't matter what level you're coaching at, you still want your team to succeed. And I wanted my boys to succeed in everything they did this year because I cared about them and I wanted to do it well. But those moments, whether you say it's the last game of the season or tournaments, as we'll probably touch on, like, it's so hard to be self-aware enough when it comes to your own behavior and the way you carry yourself when that pressure comes on. And we're talking still about amateur sport here. We're not talking about a genuinely high-performance context, but what I wanted to do was ensure the players were high-performing in their context. And I think that's where you can, you know, control some things and manage things, whether it's tournament week or whether it's through the league, to ensure that they do have the best chance of being the best version of themselves.
Yeah, and then high-performing can mean lots of things, can't it? It can be showing empathy to one of your teammates when they've just made a mistake. And I think in the business world, like, now some of those types of ideas are starting to get spoken about more and more of what is high performing, what are the behaviors and the characteristics that lead to, you know, whatever it is that you're looking to achieve. So yeah, framing it in that way is super cool. I really like it. I really like that way. And so I'm curious around the values and the teams versus your own. Were they the same? You mentioned being calm. Mm. Was that a team value, like being calm on the pitch as well as on the sideline as a coach?
It wasn't bedded in by them as one of the sort of top five values. So they had, I mean, they did a whole bunch of group work and there's all these sketches on paper that they did around what was important, and we sort of distilled it down, as I said earlier. But for me, I had some great learning experiences overseas. I remember going to a tournament in Germany where, long story short, the players on the opposition were diving and cheating and the coaches weren't behaving well, and that those players had sort of raided our dressing room before the game, put water in the kids' boots, like some real poor stuff went on. Like, it was bad because we were a club that they wanted to beat at the time. And my colleague and I, who's still a friend who I keep in touch with regularly, reflected after that game where we had a player sent off. It was a poor decision in a really fiery game, unnecessary at the age group of 13 and 14 year old children, right? You're talking about academy football. But we then found ourselves feeling so protective of the kids that we were both up and about on the sideline. We immediately went from sitting down in the first 10-15 minutes to being up and about and behaving in a way which was coming from a good place, but the loss we had in our emotional control, because we were frustrated and angry about what we were seeing in terms of behavior from the opposition, caused our kids to lose their heads. And I remember sitting in the shade, leaning against a fence at this tournament and just talking, the two of us going, what were the big lessons there? And we lost the game. It wasn't a good sort of afternoon.
It's contagious, isn't it?
Yeah,
like,
it's
I love
so
that
contagious.
Word because it plays out in so many instances where, like, if I come home from work in a shitty mood,
yeah,
like, that's contagious.
Totally.
And very quickly the whole house has been brought down.
And
it works both in a negative and a positive way. If I walk into the door, you know, pump myself out with a bit of music on the way home in the truck and and walk in bouncing and really present and engaged, then that's contagious as well.
Yeah.
But you have to be so on the money to make sure that that's where you're at.
Yeah, I think there were certain things that were expected around, like how we carry ourselves, how we behave, and the non-negotiables might have been around work ethic and desire and commitment to the team. So the question asked to the team was, are you ready to commit to this? Like, it's all good and well to put the values down, but are you willing to give everything to get what you want? As opposed to, again, when we had that sort of low point through the middle of the season, you know, I challenged them and I said, I believe some of you are pretenders right now. You know, some of you aren't living what you said you want to do.
So what were you seeing? Because commitment's a really interesting word. And often I think it gets translated into you need to do more.
Yeah.
So can you like pull on that thread a little bit? Because if commitment means doing more, it can very easily become too much.
The biggest thing I was seeing was a lack of accountability and blame. So it was that, you know, we want to be a brotherhood. We want to be connected. But oh, if it goes wrong, I'm going to point at my mate, or I'm going to dig somebody out, or I'm going to, you know, throw my hands in the air and not do the work that I need to off the ball. So little things creeping in.
Do you think that's innately human? Because, I mean, that shows up in my kids. It shows up in me. You know, like the easier thing to do, almost the innate thing to do is to blame, is to not take accountability and say, oh, it's not my fault. It was this person did that, or that other person did that, or whatever, as opposed to looking inward.
Mm. I think, you know, adult or child, and particularly hard for a developing teenager, like emotional control is an oxymoron for me. Like that, there is no such thing. You know, we do our best, but how often are we genuinely in control of our emotions? And there'll be people who are mindfulness experts far beyond my knowledge who will, I'm sure, have a counter to that. But the idea that we can get kids to self-regulate in these pressure cookers. And I did have a player this year who at halftime in a game was borderline, you know, panic attack, you know, real genuine anxiety issue. And my response there was to put an arm around him, give him a cuddle and say, this is your choice, but I believe in you. And so I don't care about whether we win or lose. The worst thing at the end of the season is we come second to another team. Like, doesn't really matter in your life, but right now I'm giving you a chance to make that decision.
Yeah. So, okay. How I think about that is, and the more I do it, the more I realize that it's super challenging to work on emotional intelligence at a time in development where the limbic system is leading the thinking.
Mm.
Stereotypically, right?
Yeah.
But I think we can entrench beliefs about those behaviors if we act in a certain way compared to another. So you're talking about putting your arm around a kid, telling him that you believe in it and it's all right and we can work through this. So I think then the belief that I'm no good, that I don't belong, that I can't do it, is not going to get attached to that behavior anywhere near as much as it would if you were critical.
Mm.
Mm. So that I think that's where the magic lies for us doing the work, is it's less about solving the problem of emotional regulation and more about setting them up to do that in the future.
Yeah, we
end up. And I've just kind of, that's just come to mind just now, because it's such an interesting characteristic for me at the moment, and it's.
Mm. But I saw a genuine improvement, not only across the team, but in that individual.
So from handling pressure in the heat of the moment.
100%. So this was a player, if I take this player as an example, who at the start of the season I was unsure of. The start of the season didn't always get selected in the starting team, for example. And it was one of those where I was, just not quite convinced. And there were other players who were performing probably better. But as time went on, started to show some real quality, had this kind of moment, and we had this moment together. And he then subsequently completed the game. We drew the game, which didn't matter. But at the end of the day, like, I remember talking to him afterwards, just saying, I'm so proud of you. Like, you got through. You got through that game when you wanted to walk after 45 minutes. And then following that, there
care,
was...
Care, compassion, love.
Yeah, so that was a lesson for me. Like, not saying I wasn't doing it previously, but I thought from that moment, like, I'm still really only 4 or 5 months into getting to know these players. Like, they have to trust me. It's going to take more than a season. Especially if you haven't been selected a few times, you're not sure on the bloke who's running the team, you know. So, but there was a tangible shift on the back of that game and a couple of games mid-season where, frankly, it was not a footballing ability issue that cost us a couple of games or found us in those positions with those individuals. It was the stress of the environment for the kids. And I've said to a few people, I found myself feeling more like a psychologist than a coach over the last 6 weeks. But the group collectively started to be far more composed on the ball, composed in their decision making, composed in the way they carried themselves.
Once more of us realised that that's the foundation of what we do. Now, I'm not suggesting that we all need to go out and get qualified, and we need to know our boundaries. But the sooner we get to a point where more of us realise that that the psychology of the environment is foundational, I think, you know, the better we're all going to be. Because, I mean, that just rings, it's exactly the same in my work. One of my young girls turned up the other day, and I had a session planned. Very quickly, I realised that session was going to have to change.
Yeah.
And we spent the whole session just hanging out and chatting and trying to make sense, help her make sense of the last week that was. Because at that moment, it was just overwhelmingly confusing.
So talk to us about that context. What were some of the challenges faced, as much as you can share around this, and how did you tackle that?
Yeah, so selection issues, not understanding decisions that were made by the adults, the coaches, some of the parents, like a misalignment between what some people were telling her and what other people were telling her, which was incredibly confusing. So, you know, over here I'm getting this information that says I can do these things and I have this level of ability, and then over here other people saying, well, no, you don't, and you're not quite as good as you think you are. And then that colliding with the person that she believes she is and who she also wants to become. And just kind of getting to the point where I could visibly see those cogs turning in her head and it just becoming too much. And not being able to make sense of all of that information. And I think oftentimes the outcome for that is just to push harder into one particular corner. Like, I just have to do more of this. I just have to do more of this. I just have to prove myself. When in actual fact, I think taking a big step back and trying to make sense of why we've got to this point, kind of, it took the roadblock away from some other paths that she could go down, and all of a sudden, because my thing with performance anxiety or just feeling overwhelmed is it like a fundamental feeling of feeling stuck.
Yeah,
I'm just stuck and I don't know where to go. So I'm just going to try and bash down the door even harder.
Yeah.
But I think, we need to take a big step back and go, well, there's other doors we can walk through, but I've got to help her see them.
I think that's so interesting around, it's almost like a stopping point, isn't it? Or a fork in the road moment, where sometimes, just having time to breathe. You know, I know we've talked extensively in the past about how overcooked some kids are in sport in general, across demands from different clubs or schools and the system probably failing them in terms of its structure and design. And so sometimes those moments, just when you think about the mental side of sport, having that opportunity to breathe and go, yeah, we're just going to step away, or we're going to offer this support because that's what's needed right now, is so much more important than just planning the next session and sticking to the program.
Yeah, it's like Connect Four. You know the game Connect Four, if you remember from our childhood. I think it's still around. Oftentimes there's just counters of different colours all over the board. And, you know, the successful player in Connect Four can see the patterns, can see the steps ahead, and actually set that up in order to get to the point where you can connect for. And so I think that's, you know, our coaching job, particularly in this stage of development, mid to late teens, is to make sense of the environment for, you know, to help them make sense of the environment. I think about it as connecting dots as opposed to just collecting them.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, I think, there's a lot to that.
Yeah, we could unpack that at a different time. But anyway, let's get back to tournaments, because that's where we were headed. And you've spent a bit of time at tournaments. So what's your take on tournaments, and where do you want to take, you know, the next section of the pod?
I think the interesting thing for me is there's so many variables in a tournament. So when it comes to successfully getting through one, like, we were a goal away from not being in the top 16 in the pool group, right? So that then changes the week. And I was sort of scraping the barrel of motivational theory, thinking, how the hell do I get these players up if we don't get through to where they want to go by the Wednesday. And I know there were a lot of coaches who I spoke to who were sort of saying it was pretty hard if you didn't make that top 16, top 8 to keep the players going.
Is that because you had a tough draw, you underperformed?
Oh, no, we were comfortable with how we performed, but I think it's just the fine margins with tournament format. Mm. So I had a lot of reflections after the tournament about the adults that design the tournament. So, for example, my players, we played 20 minutes of extra time in the final. My players played 470 minutes in 5 days. And the games were 60 to 70 minutes. First 2 days, there were two games a day. Then it was one game a day from there. So 7 games, 470 available minutes. And one thing I saw, and again, I spoke to other coaches from different schools about this. By the end of the week, Thursday, Friday, some schools had 3 or 4 left on the bench because they're only allowed to take 17 players. Now, why would we, and I appreciate there has to be a number of players who can go, why would we say you can only take 17 players when you name 16 for your game and you can only use 5 subs when you've got all of those minutes and physical loading of kids who have played school and club sport all year? So, first of all, I think the format and the selection numbers don't allow for schools to bring enough players to actually perform, and the game slows down as fatigue kicks in over the week. So this is all around the physical. Why couldn't we add another player or two and say, hey, you can name everybody and they can all be there with their friends because they're still children and participate in their sport, but then the rules of the game dictate you can only use 5 subs in that game. So 3 or 4 might miss out, but they're going to play the next game. So that's a simple one to fix. Let's just make the squad slightly bigger, and then maybe some players who are development players for these schools get an experience that they wouldn't have otherwise had as a younger player to come along and be at one and attend one and be a great teammate and maybe get limited minutes, but the next year they go and they've seen it. So that was the first thing. The physical loading was crazy, and again, that's part of navigating tournaments. You know, you've got to rotate your squad and make sure that you do things right. So we plan the day to the minute. We had a physio, we ensured we had a pool at the motel to make sure the kids could get in a cold pool when needed. We were resourced as best we could within this context to ensure their physical well-being. But there was a lot of schools, and we had injuries too, who had injuries that were, you know, pretty bad early in the week, and suddenly you're down to a few players, and that's just hard luck, right? But we can address that by allowing more children to be there.
Mm. I mean, I've always thought that tournaments are incredibly taxing physically, yeah, on the young athlete. And, you know, from a physiological point of view, it doesn't matter how much ice baths you do,
that's right,
how much protein you eat,
yeah,
you can't recover.
No.
And every time you go back out on the pitch, that you know, you're down 5% from what you were last time.
Mm.
And there's a tipping point where, and it's individualized based on the athlete and their training history, their robustness, their ability to understand and know their bodies, mm, and all of those sorts of things. But
yeah,
it's a little bit like rolling a dice,
totally,
you know, and injuries always happen more at tournaments than they do during the round robin.
Mm.
Do you think that this is something that, you know, we can improve marginally and that's okay, or do we need to completely rethink how much kids are doing in that week?
Yeah, I think we can consider how much they're doing, but I also think, like, it's a cool challenge. I'm not saying I do think pushing through and having to deal with fatigue and deal with adversity is a good thing in terms of learning. Like, I don't think it should always just be easy. And it's a test for a coaching team or a team of staff as well to go, how do we navigate this week? And we tried to get rest into a few of our players early in the week to ensure that at least they'd had some. If we had sickness, we sort of shifted the players around rooms and we tried to manage that. So, you know, we had a couple that were sick. We had a couple with knee injuries by the end of the week. And so, yeah, for me, it's a simple one to go, hey, we could potentially reduce the duration of the games and we could potentially take more players. That would be
super interesting of how it's a different equation, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, all of a sudden, health,
yeah,
arguably becomes the most important thing. If we can get our more players better recovered and in a greater state of health, then we're probably going to go pretty well.
The standard goes up too. I think the other big reflection for me was the behaviours of all the participants around tournament, the pressure. And interestingly, I had a message online the other day from a guy who'd been at the Ames Games, which I shared with you prior to this catch-up, and he talked about some of the parental behaviours he saw around football at the Ames Games just being truly awful. Now, I wasn't there, so I'm just sharing a story from somebody that was. But I think we're seeing this kind of when tournaments come and players want to win, they all want to get the result, win the trophy, whatever. That's every single team that turns up. And then you've got the adults, whether it's on the sideline, whether it's coaches, whether it's support staff. How do we carry ourselves and how do we behave towards officials, towards each other? And I'm certainly not sitting here saying I was perfect through the week. There were things I look back on and think there were moments where I was tested. There were moments where I wanted to protect the players, or there were moments where I could have done things differently. But overall, I was pretty proud with the way our staff handled themselves. And there were some comments and things I heard from other teams that were pretty disappointing. So I think we've got to reflect on, yep, it's important to go there, have an experience. It's a great tournaments do present an awesome opportunity for kids to get together, be with their friends, experience a week in camp. It's a campaign of sorts. And just sort of connect and bond and make memories. And going back to the purpose of the squad at the start of the year and the values and mapping that out, like one of the things that was 100% a priority for me was let's create some stories and memories. Like that's the objective here. So whether we'd finished first or sixth or whatever else, like you can still create great stories of that week. And I know I went to plenty of tournaments where we certainly didn't get near winning them as a kid. And I still remember the experiences, particularly off the pitch.
Yeah, so how do you think about creating memories? Because it's like I'm just curious. And it's funny, I've been digging into a little bit of the happiness research, yeah. Like as a personal interest more than anything. And there's a guy, Arthur C. Brooks, he's just released a book with Oprah. Super, super interesting. And the cool thing about it is it's all science-led, so there's a lot of evidence behind what he talks about. And I think there's three components from memory: enjoyment, satisfaction, and purpose and meaning. Like that's where happiness really comes from, right? And you're talking about memories, he distinguishes between pleasure and enjoyment with people and memories. So we can go and drink a box of beers by ourselves and get pleasure from it, but if we're not doing it with our mates and we're not creating memories, then it's not actually enjoyable, and it's not going to help us with our happiness. It was an interesting piece as an aside, but it comes into here around creating memories. So how do you create an environment that's deliberate around memories?
I know regularly we talked about what story are they going to create for themselves. So that might have been, again, it could have been a halftime conversation. Like, what's the story of the second half going to be? Like, that could be a really cool story to share and to celebrate afterwards.
Do you remember an example? Like, it would be super cool to be able to shine a light on how this actually plays out with sharing an example or two.
I think, so there's a few examples around that, so I'll probably choose a different one. But what I did do, the course I'm doing at the moment, this pro license course, they've talked a lot about campaign theming. So that's been some of the stuff we've worked on. Now, I didn't explicitly theme the week, but certainly used video throughout the season to use imagery and some keywords or sentences or phrases around where we're heading, and trying to connect some imagery to some of those values like brotherhood and I guess climbing the mountain a little bit. So there's a lot of mountains in some of this imagery. And then through the week at tournament, we would have a team meeting the evening after the game. We'd have a preview in those final 3 days before the games when we had a bit of extra time and we're only playing once a day. And so I tried to use some imagery that the kids would relate to. So we talked in one game about going in and doing a bit of a hit job and making sure we get in and get out. So we used Assassin's Creed references. And I'd sort of spoken to one of the staff going, what are the games that the kids do? Because I'm not into gaming at all. I've got no idea what happens in gaming. But we just talked about like framing up that particular game. And so using some imagery and the boys laughed a bit because it was quite a cheesy presentation with some sort of military themes. But it was just designed to break it up and go, hey, we're going to have some fun theming up this particular day with this kind of mission. We're going to go on a mission as a group. And so, yeah, I think the idea of theming or using visuals or using imagery can be quite powerful to support the stories that we build in those groups.
Yeah, super cool. I've just had a thought that I want to get one or two of the lads on the pod and get them to share their perspectives, because I think it'd be super cool.
That would be cool.
You know, we need to do more of this, is to talk to some of our athletes and and to get them to share the stories and give their perspective.
They'd probably rip on me for that particular presentation, because I ripped on myself afterwards saying, look, hey, it was a bit, it was, you know, there was James Bond and there was ninjas and there was other bits and pieces. Mm. But again, I think you've got to keep things light, and you've got to remember that it's still just a game, and it's still just a group of players, group of kids together. And it's okay to make a bit of a dick of yourself sometimes, and put yourself and I guess be vulnerable in front of the group and go, we're going to have a laugh with this one, but here's a couple of minutes of video, and here's some ideas for tomorrow. So yeah, I think that's fun, and they can learn some lessons, and it will probably stick with them, whether it resonates or not, or they thought it was good or bad, it will stick with them.
Yeah, I 100% agree. I think it will be a long lasting memory of their time playing football at Westlake. Mm. Super cool. Was there anything else around tournaments that you thought was worthy of a discussion here, Dave?
Yeah, I think I think there's a lot to it. I think the fatigue and the physicality for me is one. At times, whether it's tournaments or leagues, some of the rules and structures we put in place, like for me, if there's one question, and that question is this the best thing for the players or the children involved, and the answer is no, we simply just have to change it. Like if we just went into every policy making meeting or system design meeting with that, is this best for the players involved, and the answer was no, we change it. So there's things, as I said, around loading, around rules and regulations, around substitutes, which sort of I think need to shift and can easily be shift. And then I think we've also got to look at the coach behavior is probably one that's fresh in my mind, around some of the things I saw and heard that concerned me, and other things, again, just referencing the conversation I shared with you from the Ames Games around how at times we can all be guilty of putting far too much pressure on children and those in our care because of the nature of tournaments. And I think that can often bring out the worst in people when it needs to be utilized as a week of learning. You know, if you fail, what did you learn? There's still something to learn. And fail could be, oh, we missed out on the top eight. It could be we missed out on the top four. Like, it doesn't have to be about winning or not winning, because without a doubt, there'll be so many teams that had memories. And for me, our story would change if we didn't win the tournament, but it still would be a great story. It'd still be a week I'd never forget. And so I think we've got to think about, yeah, just how we carry ourselves, how we behave as coaches, and that's one that's probably a whole other pod in itself. Mm. But that's certainly fresh in my mind.
Yeah, so like just real quickly then, if you were to think about your outcomes for the tournament, like where would you take that idea? You mentioned learning, and so much learning can happen in a week of a young, you know, man's life. But What were the outcomes for you? What's the criteria for success when it comes to spending a week away in a tournament?
So the stories and memories one would be a priority. From a personal perspective, my number one objective was to do everything within my power and leave no stone unturned to ensure that the kids had the best chance to perform their best. So whether that was planning the day to the minute, whether that was the recovery piece we've touched on, that was a big objective for me. What can I do as a coach or leader in this group with the support of a great team of staff do to ensure that we have the best chance of achieving what they want? So I don't think you should shy away from winning. You know, winning is part of development, and there's often this conversation. I think the conversation can be a little lost in translation, where people say, "Oh, well, if we're not focusing on winning, then it's all fluffy." But actually, winning's just a piece of the puzzle. So, standing there and saying, "Yeah, we do want to win a tournament. We do want to go there." But you don't win it by just being fired up and being what's the word that I keep hearing all the time? Being intensity. Like, how often do we hear the word intensity in sport or on sidelines? Intensity. Lift the intensity. What does that even mean? So like for me, it's the opposite. It's about what are the processes to perform. So one thing I've been very clear on is I want my team to play a certain way. I want them to play with style and confidence and composure and speed. I want to try and play quick and dominate the ball. And there's certainly some good teams around the country who try and do the same thing. And there's a lot that try and play a different way. And that's great. That's football. You can play it in so many different ways. So playing our way, playing our speed, playing our style, carrying ourselves with integrity, which was one of the boys' key five values through the week, was important. And making sure that we sort of, you know, if we were to put ourselves in the frame for that top four and you get yourselves in those exciting games, then they have the composure and the confidence to go and do what they do best. And for me, that was just about controlling what I could and then letting them go, you know, letting them go and express themselves. And they have to do it at the end of the day, right?
Yeah, cool. So you mentioned coaches and coach behavior. One of the ideas that we wanted to touch on today was around the development of coaches, peer-to-peer learning. Both you and I are involved in some coach development work, so it's timely. It's it's good discussion for me, at least, to have a bit of a chat around and pick your brains, Dave, of how you think about this. So where do you think we should start when it comes to coach development or helping coaches be better?
Let me put the question back on you then, because I think we can be a bit personal with this. Like, if we think about our own experiences as kids, what is it that drove you to get involved? So I think that's a good start point.
Like, so part of my keynote speaking at the minute is to spend a little bit of time at the start sharing my story to help the people that are listening in the audience take a moment to reflect on theirs. And we know this is just a powerful idea when it comes to behavior change, to evoke some emotion and just to reflect a little bit about where you've come from. And so, yeah, I've done quite a bit of that lately. And I grew up playing football. I grew up playing track and every other sport that I could to get outside of the classroom. But just had an experience with a coach in my second to last year at high school that didn't go very well at all. and I spent a little bit of time reflecting on that. And it was it was the circumstances that I lived through. And the way that that ended meant that I've kicked a ball for half a season since.
Lost to the game.
Yeah, and it had a really marked effect on not only how I think about football, but also how I think about people and the importance of leading with relationships. And that's that line between then and now has definitely not been a straight one, but I think, you know, as we get experience and as we age up, then we can start connecting those dots as we look back. And yeah, I generally believe that they had a massive effect on who I am today.
So let's go a little bit further. So first of all, I totally relate. I had some great teachers when I was at school and through my childhood, but I certainly relate to never having like an unbelievably good coach who, I don't know, formed those relationships or was technically superb. You know, I felt like you sort of went through just playing and there were some well-meaning volunteers, coaches, teachers through the way. So for me, that was a driver. But when it comes to developing coaches, going back to the point, if you think about your experience, that comes down to the relationship or poor interactions, poor interventions from this particular coach. Then we go back to the question on how do we better support coaches to develop? Like, you and I have probably both done it where you go in and present on practical topics around session design or the physical sides of the game or whatever else. But for me, we need to do more around this, the psychology of coaching and the importance of communication, and that can mean so many different things. So for me, that's a really good start point to reflect on, sometimes thinking back on your own experience as a player, what worked and particularly what didn't. And the importance of actually starting to understand some of these areas, which are probably so much more grey, ambiguous, and harder to educate coaches because there's no real sort of assessment at the end. Measuring impact, as you've referred to with some of the research, is usually completely qualitative and varied and so on. So that's probably a start for me as to where we need to be better.
Yeah, the relationship piece is massive, and I literally came from a catch-up, and I'm going to be doing some work within a school today, and I just made it really clear that the first piece of any coach education has to be the development of trust, because if I don't get along and vice versa with the coach who I'm there to try and help, it's really hard to shift the needle on that. Understandably so, right? Like, I think I've mentioned it before, but what is 70% of the change when it comes to these types of relationships, be it coach or coach developer, be it athlete, coach, be it whatever, comes down to the relationship, which is huge, right? Like, if I don't like, trust and believe in what you bring to the table, then it's going to be super hard. And it's funny, like, I had a conversation the other day about talent development and how murky that space is, and how we make these decisions young and we really don't know what's going to happen as kids develop and age up. And so it's almost a case of me of like filtering down what it means to be a coach and the process of coaching, and then building it back up so that we can coach through intuition, as opposed to being really specific in the way that, you know, I expect you to coach. So I think everybody has to come to their own way of coaching, but that needs to be informed by things we know to be true, or at least as close to what we know to be true as is possible. So yeah, that's where I think I, you know, and I've done a little bit of this, it's getting in and alongside people and spending time developing relationships. And and we did this quite a lot with our AD program, where we spent a lot of time making sure that the development of those relationships was pretty solid. But what I learned from that, and as coaches came into the program, was where we were heading wasn't for all of them. And so that had to be really clear and present as well. It's like, this is what we're doing. This is how we do things around here. And if it doesn't work for you, then that's cool. But this is probably not going to work. This was an environment where a lot of the coaches were pretty young, sort of university aged or a few years out. And I just don't think they were in a place ready to look inward and to really critique their own behaviors, to establish what it is that they believed in and the type of coach they wanted to be in order to move forward. And that work is hard to do sometimes. So like, have you had, like, what can you teach me around that piece, like trying to establish the foundations so that when we do bring in the more content-specific knowledge, we can actually use it and move forward with it?
Look, I think your point around coaching your own way and finding your own way is critical, and I think courses are great and workshops are great, but it's the time. You know, you need time. So you mentioned young coaches. Like, we can probably, I know I can sit here and say there were so many things I did. I know I did some great things as a young coach, but I know I did some things that are probably just wouldn't be how I would do it these days. So I think the time is critical. Like, coaching is for me a craft that is probably never mastered. And I just think that the most important attributes of the best coaches are around self-awareness, curiosity, and probably empathy would be right up there. Because it's a people business, it's a people game. And we've talked a lot about relationships and connection today. So yeah, I think it takes time when you're working with a group of coaches. I'm working with sort of probably somewhere between 8 to 12 coaches at the moment pretty regularly in the club that I'm involved in. And they've all had individual observations and feedback from me, but there's a huge degree of autonomy to go in and coach in pairs in their way within some themes and within a program. But I think the trust piece just takes time. You know, like, if you're being watched by somebody, you have to trust that they have your interests in heart, or best interests at heart, sorry. No different to a player who, you know, needs to know that you've got their best interests at heart to perform. So yeah, that is literally time. It's time spent with people, time talking to people, probably time building your own credibility in the space and understanding that what you say may add some value. But I think about the best coach developers I've been mentored by, and I think they usually start with questions and seek understanding. So it's very easy to go in and judge somebody's session or practice with a critical lens and say, hey, I wouldn't do that. You could do this, as opposed to, what was your rationale for that? Can you talk to me about where that fit in with the entire session? You know, if it was part of a practice, for example, did you notice this? Was there a reason for the fact you did that? Those questions, I've had some great conversations sitting in the dugout post sessions with coaches this year where they sort of sit and go, I didn't even notice that, like, I was just doing it. And that's cool. Like, we all get into flow. Like, we all go out there, we coach and we do our thing, and then we sort of go, man, that was great. And then, but when somebody else is feeding back to you, that can be so powerful. And the most obvious one to me is when coaches just talk for the sake of talking. So, and that could be good talk. It could be praise. It could be positive. It could be loads of good things as well, but it almost becomes commentary. And I've sat on the sideline at games this year where I've just heard, and there's been a couple of games where I couldn't even tell you who the head coach is on the other team because there's just three blokes barking at kids and talking and talking and talking, standing on the sideline, toes over the line kind of thing. It's like, dude, can we, I mean, I'll stand up, don't get me wrong, I'm standing on the sideline, but I'll sit down too. And I think that's saying that, just that self-awareness piece. Am I conscious of my body language, my posture, the way I'm communicating, how long I'm communicating for? And at times, until somebody else challenges you on that or brings that to your attention, it's hard to know it's happening. And I think that's where there's power in working with another coach. And one thing I'm really keen to do with this group next season is to ensure that we have that sort of peer-to-peer feedback mechanism in place, where maybe at the end of every session it's 5 minutes, 10 minutes, just to debrief and go, hey, I saw you do this, why did that happen? Well, I noticed this and I really enjoyed that.
Mm. And so, like, the mechanics of that for you require, I would suggest, require coaches, actually, more than one coach being in the same session.
Yep.
But coaching tends to be an island, doesn't
totally.
It?
Totally.
You know, like, yeah. And because we don't invest in it and it's under-resourced and we're scratching to get enough coaches just so that we can run the teams, it's you and your bag of balls, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think, so, you know, reflection is the piece that often is missed, mostly because of time. And I'll be honest again, like, there's times where I don't sit there and journal. Some people journal. Some people love to write things down. I've often used the car ride to reflect and think and maybe make a note of things after I get home from a session. But closing the loop on a session is something that we probably all miss because the players are racing out of our care. We're making sure they get home safely. We're packing up equipment. We want to get home ourselves probably after a long day. And so, yeah, just encouraging that reflection piece, whether that's recording yourself on video or as simple as recording yourself on audio through your phone, so easy to do and so powerful. I certainly remember being on courses in the UK where, you know, the use of video was becoming the norm 10 plus years ago, and seeing yourself and hearing yourself coach for the first time at that stage, at least in my own development, was so powerful. Doing things like timing your interventions, timing how long the ball rolled versus you talking, how many interventions, what was the detail there, or were you just validating your own existence? So, yeah, I think there's so much to it, but the conversations, at Brentford we used to sit on a Tuesday night after the session and debrief, sometimes for an hour or more, and you'd sort of be sitting there going, it's going to take me an hour to get home on the bus and the tube from here, and it's pushing 9 o'clock. But the benefit in hindsight out of those conversations, and on game day too, debriefing every player from every group, looking at our criteria around what success was, those conversations in that environment, I learned so much from, and the people and the way they saw the game and the way they saw the players and the diversity in the coaching group. Those conversations, whilst we were all tired and totally underpaid, were massive learning moments. So I think we need to do better at bringing coaches together to talk whenever we can.
Mm. Have you, at the club that you're working at the minute, do you structure the environments in a way that it requires less intervention from the coach all of the time? And it might just be one night of the week, right, where the environment actually looks after the what to do so that the coaches can come together more. They don't feel like they're having to run the session for the whole hour, because that, I think that's one of the issues we face, is the logistics that's required in order to run the session gets in the way because we feel like we're needed for the full hour or hour and a half or however long it runs for. But wouldn't it be nice if, you know, one of the nights of the week, players came in, coaches spent a bit of time setting the session up, and then they could stand on the sideline in pairs or whatever and just
observe.
Yeah, and talk to each other about what they see, and create a little bit of intent for the next session, or reflect on what happened the previous session. Like, the risk, I think the fear lies in the, yeah, but if we're not doing anything, we're not making our players better.
Goes back to control, right?
100%.
So, you know, if we're not seen by the parents who are standing on the fence to be doing something, we're not coaching. which is wrong. It's just wrong. So, yeah, I think we don't structure that. We work in pairs where one will lead and one might assist. So I think that gives the opportunity for it. But we need to do that better. Like, I'm happy to sit there and say that's something that we're betting in. And I'm already thinking about with next season in mind as to how do we structure that better.
And is that with two teams or one? Like, I think getting into the weeds here could be super helpful. Like, when you have one and a coach and an assistant, are they still just there with one team, or have you got two teams?
Yeah, it depends. Sometimes the teams, like, you might mix the 14s and 15s up and say, hey, three or four coaches work across that group, which is now larger. But generally, each team has got two coaches and they're working in pairs. So they might say, hey, I'll lead part one and two and you lead part three and four, or I'll coach the team in possession, you coach the team out. So generally, they are coaching a part. Or supporting, and so I don't think that sort of conversation, that observing and just reflecting on what's happening in front of them probably happens till later in the session when there might be more of a game training style practice or a small-sided game where the coaches can step back a bit more. But yeah, definitely, I mean, I'm making a note of that suggestion as we speak.
No, I just think that I'm unsure as to whether that's normal. I think that's a hugely fortunate position to be in, is to be able to have two coaches alongside every team, when a lot of these clubs at the grassroots level just scratching to get enough coaches there in the first place, right?
So hard to find coaches.
And it's the administration. Like, some one thing that I have learnt this season coaching ISAC was it's the administrative way that we run our lives that gets in the way of being a better parent or a better coach. Or, and so if we're constantly just administrating our kids' lives or the club or whatever, making sure that you know whatever comes next is ready to go, then we're either thinking in the past or we're thinking in the present, not the present, the future, constantly. We don't have an ability to actually look out in front and see what's happening in the moment. But the solution to that is super challenging, right? You know, like, what, somehow we need to change the way that the system works so that, you know, our kids and our parents aren't just running from one thing to the next to the next to the next. Because we have to create space for this reflective work. I don't think we can just throw it on coaches and ask them to do more of it. Because they're time poor already, aren't they?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's the biggest struggle. I mean, all of the coaches I'm working with are either working jobs, they're studying, one or two are still at school, sort of 17, 18-year-olds learning their craft and enthusiastic about it. But, yeah, like, time is everybody's rarest commodity in contemporary culture. And I think a lot of these behaviours, going back to the conversations around sideline coach, parent, even player behaviour, is just so often a reflection of the world we're living in. And that's sort of probably an overly philosophical point from my perspective, but it's something I think about a lot, just around, like, yeah, we're constantly just reflecting society, whether that's the status around winning and trophies and competitiveness, or whether that's self-interest and individualism everywhere being rife. I think these are some of the things we need to zoom out and step back and go, actually, yeah, that is happening around us, and it's probably manifesting on the sports field in any number of sports. I know in netball there's been various articles published recently about parent behaviour and sideline stuff happening in netball too, which I'm not too familiar with, but I know it's been raised. So, you know, there's issues across sport that we need to tackle, and I think space and time, whether it's to educate and support the development of those behaviours, or, as you say, give space and time for coaches to reflect and genuinely improve their practice, it's a hard thing. It's a hard thing to do.
Yeah, certainly is. And I think we have to look at the low-hanging fruit, and that has to happen within the session. Until we can get to a point where we're making change, we're helping people make change, and they're excited and interested to continue that, and then they might take that out into their own lives, and they might, you know, take 10 minutes to sit quietly in the car before they walk out onto the grass, because that can change the game. It does for me. You know, if I spend 10 minutes prior to my coaching sessions just thinking about my intent, and then as you suggested, we do the same in the car before we turn the engine on to go home, changes the game, right? That's 20 minutes a day of looking inward.
Yep, yeah.
Over a week, boom, you know? Like, it's massive, but that habit is incredibly hard to create when you're not used to brushing your teeth twice a day.
Yeah, spot on. I think, yeah, just making that time is so difficult, but so valuable if you can, right?
Cool. What else, David? There was one more on our agenda. I think we've covered it all off.
I think we've got there. I think we were going to talk a little bit about the power of conversation, but I feel like there's been a little bit of power in this conversation. And
yeah, for sure.
And sharing. It's been awesome today to share some stories and catch up. It's long overdue, mate, and hopefully of benefit to those who are tuning in.
Yeah, absolutely. And as always, if you do have any comments, questions, or you want to chip in this conversation, or you want to be a part of one even, then please reach out and share the conversation with your friends, pass it on to someone who you think will benefit, and we will see you soon in the next episode of the Athlete Development Show.